We gather with words from a former minister of this church, Edward Atkinson. We meet together to celebrate who we are, to share the insights which give meaning and hope to our lives, to learn from the wisdom of others that their truths may contribute to our understanding. We meet, we share, we learn, we celebrate our coming together. The seven Unitarian Universalist principles are the values we share as a congregation. They give us our identity and draw others to join us. When we say we affirm these principles, we are saying that we give them our stamp of approval. When we say we will promote them, we are saying that we will try to live by them and help others to accept them and also live by them. Today, Cece and Elizabeth will introduce one of the principles and tell us what it means to them.
This fall, we are focusing on the seven UU principles. Today, we celebrate the fifth UU principle. We affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of democratic process within our congregations and society at large.
Another way to say this principle is we believe that all persons should have the vote about the things that concern them.
You know, to me, this living this principle in my life means listening to my inner voice and voting on things that I feel are important. I think we all try to live that way in our country, and it's great that we get to do that in our church, too, and we all have a say.
To me, it means sometimes my teacher teaches the class how to do something and gives us the choice of how to learn things in different ways. I think it makes things a lot more fun.
In the days ahead, we ask that you be conscious of this UU principle and to think about what it means in your own life.
Please join us now in saying the words of the fifth principle as printed in your order of servants.
We affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large. Thank you both for a great job. And now, I'd like to invite you to be attentive to a wonderful story about that principle from our Director of Religious Education, Michelle Cote.
Good morning. So today I have a story for you called All People Need a Vote. And in a few minutes I'm going to stop and ask you what you think these children in this story should do to solve their problem. So please listen, okay? It was a warm summer evening in that glorious time between supper being over and having to get ready for bed. When the fireflies started to appear one by one, three children went outside to play. "But what should we play?" asked Tabitha, who was the oldest of them all, by 4 months and 2 days. She had bright shiny braces and beads braided into her hair. "Let's play tag," said Adam, who was the next oldest, by 2 months and 15 days. He always wore his baseball hat sideways, and he always wore his T-shirt tucked in. "Let's play hide-and-seek," said Cheryl, who was the youngest of the three. She had three braids in her long, dark hair, two little braids in front on either side of her face, and one bigger braid that hung down behind her back. "Tag," said Alex. "Adam, hide-and-seek," said Cheryl. "Tag, hide-and-seek, tag, hide-and-seek." "Stop it," said Tabitha, stomping her foot and crossing her arms. "Let's vote." Cheryl looked at Adam, and Adam looked at Cheryl, and they both said, "Okay." "We can have secret ballots and everything," said Tabitha. And she ran inside her house, then brought back paper and pencils and a shoebox with a skinny little hole cut in the top. Cheryl took her piece of paper and wrote hide and seek in neat and careful letters. Then she folded her paper and put it through the skinny hole in the box. Adam and Tabitha were already done. "Right, now we count them," said Tabitha, and she took the lid off the box and unfolded each paper. "Tag, hide and seek, tag. It's 2-1, tag wins." "Okay," said Cheryl, and the three of them played tag until their parents called them inside to get ready for bed. The next night, Tabitha brought the shoebox and they voted again. "It's 2-1, announced Tabitha, tag wins." Cheryl sighed, "Okay." And guess what? Tag won the next night, too, and the night after that, and the night after that. "It's not fair," Cheryl said. "But we voted on it," Alex replied, and that was true. "I And besides, they lived in a democratic country, and in a democracy, voting was the way to decide. It's still not fair, Cheryl muttered. And so the next night, when Tag won again, she decided not to play. Oh, come on, said Tabitha. Tag isn't fun with only two people. Tag isn't fun at all, Cheryl said darkly. I'm tired of playing tag. I quit. Tabitha looked at Adam, and Adam looked at Tabitha, and they both looked at Cheryl, who wouldn't look at either of them at all. Tabitha jingled the beads braided into her hair. Adam turned his baseball hat, so it pointed the other way. Then Adam said, well, maybe instead of voting all the time, we could take turns. Cheryl looked up. Take turns? Yeah, two nights playing tag, because there are two of us who like to play it, then one night playing hide-and-seek, because there's one of you. We could start tonight, said Tabitha. We could even play hide-and-seek for a couple nights in a row, because we haven't played it yet at all. How's that sound, Cheryl? That sounds great, Cheryl said. I'm going to hide. Me too, said Adam. That means you're it, Tabitha. And he and Cheryl ran off to hide, while Tabitha closed her eyes and counted, sometimes slow and sometimes a little too fast. When she got to 100, she yelled, ready or not, here I come. And on that warm summer evening, in that glorious time between supper being over and having to get ready for bed, as the fireflies appeared one by one, the three children played outside until their parents called them home.
I'd like to share a reading with you this morning. It's from an essay by a colleague of mine, the Reverend Earl Holt. It may seem surprising to find a stated commitment to democratic method or process among the core purposes of a religious organization. But perhaps less so if one remembers that Unitarian Universalism is based on two religions born in the New World in the formative years of the American Republic, each of them decisively influenced and shaped in their formative years by the same Enlightenment ideas and values that gave rise to the American Revolution and American democracy. It's no accident that so many of the founders of the Republic were also leaders in the formation of these American denominations, including, among others, Benjamin Rush, Universalist, signer of the Declaration of Independence, and Joseph Priestley, the scientist and Unitarian preacher who was a strong influence on Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. Their religious convictions were crucial in their formulation of America's political creed. For as James Madison would later say, what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? Political and religious ideas interpenetrate. For example, the political notion that a people have a right to self-government grows out of a religious conviction that human beings have the capacity to shape their own destiny, that they are not mere puppets on a divine string. Democracy, to put it another way, is more than a mechanism of governance. It is an expression of faith in the power of human beings to shape their own lives, a faith that is most explicit in the ideals of our religious tradition. In this church, everyone, member or not, is welcome to our worship and to all the programs we offer. In this church, everyone, member or not, will be served by our ministry when they're in times of need. But if you are a member, you have the right to be a full participant in this democratically run institution. You have the right to vote for those who will lead our church and on many issues that affect this congregation. That does not happen in most churches. Most churches are not run democratically as we are. And truth be told, this democracy of ours can sometimes be a bit cumbersome, time-consuming, sometimes even messy. At a meeting with some of my Unitarian Universalist minister colleagues not long ago, someone said, "Wouldn't it be great to be an Episcopal priest for just a day or two? Then you could straighten out those things that get bogged down in the process." Now, I have to admit, there have been times when that might have sounded tempting. But the truth is, not one of us would ever opt for a system of congregational decision-making that was anything other than democratic. Our reasons for supporting the use of the democratic process in our churches is not because it's more expedient. The reason we value the democratic process is not practical or even political. It's a theological reason. We as a faith tradition believe in this process because it is the manifestation of an even more fundamental belief. This is our belief in the equal worth and dignity of every person. The belief that everyone's voice is important, not just the voices of the select or the rich or the powerful. These, of course, are values we've already discussed this fall, particularly as we examined the first and the second principles. We're about to start another session of our New to UU course, where I will explore with newcomers and even longtime members who want to learn more about this faith tradition the historic journey of the Free Church. That's a little plug if you haven't signed up yet. Jolene has there's sign up downstairs. You can contact Jolene. But it's a theological journey that has moved away from the belief in a divine predetermined plan where every human action was preset by God to a view where human beings have free choice to determine their own path, a view that says we all have the capacity to shape our lives and our world. This view of human nature, along with the acknowledgement that we all have the same inherent dignity and worth, that we are committed to equality, requires that democracy be a fundamental principle of the Free Church. This inclusion of the democratic process is one of our fundamental religious principles. Often comes as a surprise to folks new to our tradition. But if we remember a bit about both our Unitarian and Universalist history, recalling, as the reading said, that we emerged and were shaped by the same influences our nation, it makes sense. You heard the reading, leaders like Universalist Benjamin Rush, who signed the Declaration of Independence, and Unitarians like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, had fundamental ideas that were both political and religious. Earl Holt used a great word to describe the relationship. He said, they interpenetrate. Politics and religious ideas interpenetrate. The famous 20th century Unitarian minister A. Powell Davies said that democracy was in fact the social and political expression of a religious principle. So yes, as a religious tradition, we affirm and promote the use of the democratic process. But that's only the beginning of the discussion. We do not affirm and promote the democratic process to the exclusion of all other principles. It does not and it should not stand alone as we approach issues in our society and in our church. It's not our only principle, and if it were, we would be in serious trouble. Both our church and our government have to be more than just the expression of the view of the majority. The democratic process, like any other kind of governance, has its weaknesses and is subject to abuse. You all know the Winston Churchill quote, "Democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others." Raw self-interest, every person for themselves democracy, will not produce justice and will not move us forward either as an institution or as a nation. The great preacher from Riverside Church, William Sloan Coffin, put it this way, democracy does not guarantee that virtue is exercised. In the history of our nation, there have been many sad periods where the democratic process itself was used to institute and maintain injustice. We need only look at the history of segregation and racism and slavery to see how the majority speaking through the democratic process can be very unjust. And it's exactly because the democratic process has this potential negative side that it's only half of the fifth principle. The fifth principle reads in its entirety, we affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and our society at large. It's only by pairing a well-developed conscience with the use of the democratic process that we're able to make decisions that go beyond our self-interest. It's only when conscience is combined with the democratic process that we make decisions that are generous, loving, and wise. It is the calling of that small voice inside of each of us that can help us from abusing the democratic process. Indeed, it is the role of religion to bring conscience to the democratic process. By tying the call of conscience to the exercise of the democratic process, we Unitarian Universalists hope to bring only the best of ourselves to participate in the democracy of our nation. Of course, what we perceive to be our own interest is always important, but we must think about others as well. It is our conscience that calls us to be more than just for ourselves. The call of conscience often means you give up some control you might otherwise have in order to make way for something better to happen. It means being willing to stand with someone who is different from you rather than always standing with those who are just like yourself. Intuitively, we may think that if the process is fair, then the result will be. But that's only so if the process is not one blinded by self-interest, but one guided by a conscience well-informed of the needs of others. Let's recap by going back to the story Michelle told. I love that story because it gets it all. As is often the case, it's not just a children's story. When the three children in that story found themselves in conflict, they tried to use a formal voting approach to resolve their differences. But they found out, though the procedure felt right, the result did not. The group was stressed and ready to break up, even though they'd used what we might, at least at first blush, acknowledge as a fair and appropriate means to resolve a dispute. However, they came to realize that in order for the group to be happy together, they had to think about more than just their personal preferences and make room for those who were different. This route required deeper discussion and understanding of each other to proceed. This time, the decision was made by consensus and not by voting. And in the process, there was more acceptance of each other's point of view and more trust between them. Yet, at core, it was every bit as democratic. This time, they moved from making a decision purely based on self-interest to one where they each took into account the needs and the desires of the other. And what happened in that story? The change brought variety into their afternoon playtime. It was not only beneficial to the one child who wanted to play hide and seek, but beneficial to all three. We too benefit when we're willing to make room in the democratic process for views that are beyond our own self-interest. It seems to me that this generous kind of democracy, the democracy that is guided by conscience, that takes into account real interests, not special interests, is having a tough time. Right now, as I look at our country, I have a concern about how democracy is working. Let's start with the most basic aspect of the democratic process, the right of each citizen to vote. Over the last several years, many state legislatures have passed some form of voter ID laws and other voting restrictions on such things as poll hours and early voting, which have the effect of preventing many qualified people from voting. Bills are pending presently and state legislatures to do more of this. And the number is on the rise since the Supreme Court just this summer struck down a provision of the Voting Rights Act, which allowed the federal government to review actions by states which had a history of making it difficult for some to exercise their right to vote. Let's face it, there are those in our nation who are working to make it difficult for people of color, poor people, old people, people who are of a different socioeconomic class and background to vote. Some argue that these laws are really ways to prevent fraud, but none have shown any significant amount of fraud in the system that demands this. These only slightly masked efforts to deny the vote to many people are, by anyone's standard, morally wrong. What our fifth principle calls us to do, you remember, is to promote democracy, which means to make it as easy as possible for each citizen to vote, even the ones we may disagree with. Threats at this fundamental level of the democratic process are very troubling, but as serious as those threats are, these attempts to limit the right of some to vote pale, I think, in terms of the negative impact they have on the democratic process when compared to another great threat to democracy. I want to be very clear. This other threat to democracy, which I believe to be the greatest threat to its future, is not a concern with one political party or perspective, but what is happening with both parties and among both liberals and conservatives. This concern goes, I believe, to the very heart of the functioning of the democratic process, and in my opinion, is a moral question of the highest order upon which all religions in this country should be speaking out. We just sang that great hymn, great old hymn, which begins with, "Once to every soul and nation comes a moment to decide in the strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side." I know they're kind of old-fashioned words, but they come from a James Russell Lowell poem entitled "The Present Crisis," and they remind us that there are critical moments when we are called to stand boldly for what's right, and I believe that we're at one of those moments now in relation to our democratic process. Particularly since the Citizens United Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago, but also long before, money has been the name of the game in politics. From the incredible amount of money spent lobbying Congress to the donation of millions of dollars by single individuals to PACs, which essentially today fund the campaigns of those running for the highest office in the land. I don't know about you, but it seems pretty obvious to me that government is for sale. It is impossible for me to believe that any politician, liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, can directly or indirectly accept this kind of huge money and not feel obligated to advance and support the agenda of the donor. Now, I know what's happening here is not illegal, but I'm reminded of a line learned many years ago in divinity school and has always stuck with me. It's from the 10th chapter of the first book of Corinthians, not something usually quoted, but it says, "All these things are lawful, but not all lawful things are helpful. Not all lawful things serve to build us up as a society." For the most part, the money in the system is technically legal, but I don't think it's morally right. It's not helping build up the future of a strong democracy. Many have called what's going on in our government today legal bribery. Recently, I heard an interview on NPR with an American, just this week, you may have heard it, with an American who teaches U.S. political science in China to Chinese students. And he said that by and large, the Chinese students admire the two-party system and the free debate. But what they have a hard time understanding is how the money paid to politicians could be legal. It's a rather stinging critique of our democracy from people who have very little democracy. shows you kind of how obvious it is if you step back, I think. It seems to me that somehow we need to get the money out of politics. If we could, I think we would have a very different government. One where the people's representatives actually had what's in the best interest of everyone in their hearts, even the ones that aren't giving them great amounts of money. Where true and honest discussion and debate about what is right for our nation could take place. Small fixes to campaign laws are not going to do it. Disclosure laws are not going to do it. I personally believe we need a total reform package, probably some kind of publicly funded campaign for all offices where government gives a qualified candidate funds and also generous amounts of television and radio time to get their message out. Many say that in light of the Supreme Court's recent decision, it would probably require a constitutional amendment to do this, and we know that's not an easy thing. But I'm not here this morning to propose a worked-out political solution. That's not the role of religion, even a religion that affirms the role and the use of the democratic process as a fundamental principle. My message is, and the role of religion, I think, should be to point out what are serious, pressing moral threats to democracy and to bring the voice of conscience to the debate. And frankly, I think those two issues, it's pretty obvious where the voice of conscience takes you. Finally, you really can't preach this sermon on the fifth principle at this time without reflecting what's going on right now in our greatest democratic institution, the United States Congress. This government shutdown and this teetering on the verge of defaulting on our financial obligations as a nation seem to me, anyway, to be another example of the democratic process in trouble. The problem, I believe, has its roots in another immoral practice, gerrymandering, where one political party draws the congressional district lines in a state so as to elect only those who believe in a certain way. And as a result, the election of representatives who have no sense of real responsibility to the greater needs or concerns of the whole. It essentially allows them, because their district is so homogeneous, it even encourages them, you might say, to act in destructive rather than constructive ways in government. You know, compromise is a dirty word. They really represent only a small portion of the electorate, and I want to be clear. They should represent them well. They have a right and an obligation to speak in times of debate for that group. They have a right and an obligation to speak their own conscience. But, you know, the final principle of democracy is that after full and fair debate, after we are sure that everyone got to participate and the individual rights of the minority were protected, we reach a final position, which is the clear will of the majority. And then those who lose have to abide by the will of the majority. Earlier, we spoke of situations in our nation, particularly in relation to race, where we experience the tyranny of the majority, where individual rights and access to the political system were denied by majority rule. But there's also such a thing as the tyranny of the minority. A small group in Congress using what I would say are unethical tactics to essentially block the democratic process from working. The Speaker of the House, fearing he could lose his position, will not allow the democratic process to go forward. You know, the health care bill has been debated and can be debated again. There are people in this country that strongly oppose it, and they have every right to continue to express their opinion and even propose new legislation. What I don't believe they ethically have a right to do is to throw a wrench in the entire workings of government and hold it hostage to their views. Does it not seem insane to you that right now there are enough votes to end this shutdown that's hurting so many and move on with the business of government, but one group is preventing the vote from taking place? Sometimes the greater good has to take precedence over smaller local interests. And it takes courage, surely, to act that way. But I think that's what statesmanship is. That's what I want to see from those who are elected by the people to take the awesome responsibility of governing our nation. And I just don't see much statesmanship right now. Do you? Instead, what I see is pandering to special interests, horse trading your deal for my deal, and cover your butt tactics. That's what I see. The famous Gettysburg Address, Lincoln ended with the line, "The government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth." I worry, in fact, that it could perish if we continue as we are on the road we're on. I think we're on a road that's leading us to a government that is not by the people or for the people. I know these are strong words I've spoken. I know they verge on the political process, but we as an institution have made that part of our religious way of being. These moral issues have been eating at me for some time, and the more I think about it, the more I think that we are unlikely to address any really significant other issues in our country until we address these fundamental issues. You know, ultimately, the great hope, that is the very reason for the theological principle of democracy guided by conscience, is differences will be heard. Yes, there will be winners and losers. But in the end, the great hope in the end is, whether it's in our church or our town or our country, that we will come together as one. In these difficult and divided times, I invite you to work for, to pray for, that that be so. I thought I'd take our benediction from one of our great ministers of the past, Theodore Parker, who wrote, "Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living." And now I invite you to sing a benediction to each other as printed in your order of service.